from WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for the vacationing Terry Gross. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with former Watergate prosecutor Archibald Cox. President Nixon ordered his firing in 1973, and it's taken Cox 14 years to write about it. Also today, I'll speak with actor Danny Glover. This year, he appeared opposite Mel Gibson in the film Lethal Weapon. He made his debut on Broadway in Master Harold and the Boys, and now appears as Nelson Mandela in an upcoming HBO special. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by guitarist Tom Verlaine, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Fatal Attraction, starring Glenn Close and Michael Douglas. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is Archibald Cox. A leading authority on constitutional law and labor law, he is now the Carl M. Loeb University Professor Emeritus at Harvard University. Professor Cox has held a number of positions in federal government, including chairman of the Wage Stabilization Board in 1952. During the 1960 presidential campaign, he was one of Senator John F. Kennedy's principal advisors and was appointed by President-elect Kennedy as the new Solicitor General of the United States. In May 1973, Archibald Cox became the first Watergate Special Prosecutor, setting up and directing the Watergate Special Prosecution Force until he was fired at the request of President Nixon in October 1973. Archibald Cox has written several books on labor law, civil rights, the Supreme Court, and freedom of expression, and his new book, published by Houghton Mifflin Company, is entitled The Court and the Constitution. Welcome to Fresh Air, Professor Cox.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here on this auspicious day.
Well, it is a wonderful day to be here in Philadelphia, both to reflect on the accomplishments of the past and also on the challenge and opportunities passed on to us to try to do as much the same thing as we can for our children and their children.
And that's exactly why we're talking to you
today. Yes, and I'm sure that's what the framers would wish us to do if they could be here, to think of the future and the obligations that go with it as well as the opportunities, and not just of them in the past. Mm.
Let's talk just a little bit about the past, though, because the first chapter of your book, The Court and the Constitution, you call it the miracle at Philadelphia. Miracle. Interesting word.
I stole that title from a Philadelphian, Catherine Drinker Bowen, who wrote a wonderful, fascinating book under that title quite a few years ago. She stole it from George Washington. And I think James Madison also spoke of the miracle, because remember it took, from May to September, and there were times when the delegates were insulting each other so that almost at the stage of, there's no use sitting down together tomorrow. Mm. Then they appointed a committee, and they stuck at it and finally did come up with the Constitution, an extraordinary document. I sometimes think that even more miraculous than the delegates from these jealous, selfish states, even more miraculous than their coming together, was the miracle that the Constitution, with a few very important changes, but very few, as a document, has survived 200 years with no other changes in the text, in the basic document. It's unique in that respect to other constitutions, many rather patterned after it, adopted in other countries, have been thrown on the junk pile of history.
Why do you think ours has survived so long, so intact?
Why has it lasted so long? Well, I think there are three reasons. I think the remarkable thing about the delegates, above all else, was that they blended a very practical politician's awareness of the springs of human action, how and why people tick, along with a great deal of reading and study of all forms of government in the past, And they had a tremendously important sense of the interplay between the two, how the institutions they would create over the long pull would affect the way leaders behaved and people behaved. I sometimes think when I reflect on the select committees on the Iran-Contra crisis that I rather wish they would ask themselves, is there anything in the organization of the White House, the people just under the president, that explains why twice within 15 years we have had very high in the government what attitude of disregard for law, contempt of law, whereas one of the things that has ensured us 200 good years on the whole in American history has been that principle that even the highest officials in the government are subject to law.
Hmm. Do you think that contempt perhaps for the law came because of the nature of the men themselves who had the power at the time?
Well, I think that the positions, let's say, provided a fertile soil. Of course, it's partly the individuals. But I think the uncontrolled growth of White House staff, with their enormous power, plus the fact, if one thinks about it, that most of the men appointed to White House positions in the last 25 years have, in a public sense, been nobodies when they were appointed. Not all of them, but most of them had no place in public life, and thus they were wholly dependent on one man's smile or frown to lose their power, and began to forget that they owed obligations to, well, as we say today, we the people, that it wasn't just that one man, a monarch, that they owed obligations to. And I think that's partly an institutional, so I think it was the conjunction of the two.
Do you agree with people like Attorney General Edwin Meese that we should concentrate on the intent of the Constitution? I mean, first of all, how can we? How can 200 years ago the founding fathers have known about things like life support systems, computers, new technologies? But just as a term, just as a principle.
The word original intent and intent, you know, they're awfully slippery words. What is meant by them? I think there's sort of two extremes of meaning that it's worth mentioning. One is, what did the framers consciously think and intend? And as you suggest, there are lots of things today that the framers couldn't possibly have foreseen or had any intent one way or another about. Then there is also a much broader underlying purpose or policy. Let me put a fairly simple illustration. The first ironworks in the United States, I think, was in Saugus, Massachusetts, and it was started a little after 1800 sometime. If you'd asked those framers who were still around, do you intend Congress to have power to regulate employment at the Saugus ironworks? Of course, they said no. Not possibly. In 1937, the Supreme Court interpreted the commerce power to hold that Congress did have that power. So if you talk specific intent, it was at war with the specific intent. If you define the purpose more broadly, as John Marshall, our greatest Chief Justice, did, and say the evident purpose of the Constitution was to give the federal government power to regulate those things that affect more states than one, and to reserve to the states the power to deal with things that affect only the state, then you would say, well, the Saugus Ironworks in 1800 didn't affect more states than one, so anybody would notice it, whereas U.S. steel mills in Pittsburgh or Jones and Laughlin obviously did. The economy had changed, the processes of manufacture had changed. I think the intent in the broader sense of the underlying purpose or policies, what ideals motivated the framers, remains important. I think there are times when we go beyond it. I couldn't say that with historical accuracy, that the intent of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment was to wipe off the books all the laws discriminating against women. But I think the Supreme Court's decisions that laws discriminating against women violate the Equal Protection Clause today was a wise and right decision. I think the great bulk of the country thinks so, too.
My guest is Archibald Cox. The 14th Amendment is one that's evoked quite often. It's been referred to almost as a second Bill of Rights for us.
Yes, because what it did, put most simply, and sloughing over some hard questions, the Bill of Rights guaranteed citizens' liberties only against invasion by the federal government, by the president or the Congress. The 14th Amendment guaranteed us individual rights against infringement by the states. And so it's a Bill of Rights against the state, if you're not speaking too precisely, because they're not exactly coextensive.
Do you think that there's a need for a new constitutional convention? There's been a lot of talk about that, a cry for it almost.
Well, a cry, if I may say so, about rather foolish things. No, I think there is no need for a new constitutional convention. I suggest in the book, and I've sometimes said, that part of the genius of the framers was their ability to say enough but not too much. That they spoke, when you think about it, I spoke of the phrase to regulate commerce among the several states, leaves all kinds of questions unanswered. Guarantee against deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Again, the freedom of speech is a majestic phrase, but its precise application was left to the future. They couldn't agree on a lot of things. That's why they put them off. And I think they were wise enough to know that they couldn't foresee a lot of things. And one reason the Constitution has lasted 200 years, I think, is that the Supreme Court, when it became the authoritative voice of the Constitution, has been able both to meet the needs of the community at the time of the decisions, but it has also followed a method of constantly preserving the links with the past, as I would put it as a law professor, regarding itself as bound, but not too strictly, by the continuing, evolving body of law that is ever constant, even though it's ever changing.
That seems almost an ideal, though. I mean, lately it seems that nominations to the Supreme Court are politically motivated. I know this has also happened in the past as well, but is there a danger that the Supreme Court could actually become a political tool for the powers, whatever powers that be at the time?
When I'm in a black mood, I worry greatly about that. I'm essentially an optimist believer. I've always read a lot of history, especially our American history, and when you see what people have accomplished in the past, you have to believe if we get to work, we can accomplish like things in the future. But I do worry that the tendency today, right immediately, is to politicize the court, I really think in the selecting of judges, I'm thinking of all the federal courts now, in a degree that has never been done before, far more explicitly. We'll go and get people we think will decide the cases right. And it's also the court has, say, in the last 25, maybe 35 years, been a good deal freer in deciding cases according to what the justices think meets the needs of the country, and a good deal less attentive to what I call the continuing body of law. And those two trends sort of feed each other. But there's always been some policy. It's a dilemma. Mm. It's the only way you can define the role of the court, in my judgment, is to state two inconsistent propositions. On the one hand, it must follow the law, and on the other hand, it must meet the needs of the community. But I do suggest, to put it briefly, that this is probably what would happen if you and I went out and met some people on the street and asked them, how do you expect a judge to decide a case? Do you want him to do what he thinks is right or to follow the law? Well, once we persuaded them we were serious and not crazy, I think they'd say, no, he should follow the law. If we then said, well, you mean he should be bound by precedent regardless of justice? Oh, no, he ought to do what's just.
Mm.
I think, but, you know, sure, it's an ideal, it's an aspiration. But I suggest to you that, in a way, if we, our aspirations are part of us, in the broad sense, all of us, but also individuals, and that if we work on the aspirations, seek to achieve them, the consciousness of the effort and the confidence of the people that the effort is being made by the court is enough, even though they can never achieve the ideal perfectly.
Mm. Is there any truth to the rumor that had President Kennedy lived, you might have been appointed to the Supreme Court?
Well, that has been printed, and I'm sure I don't know. There was an interesting little incident. The former Solicitors General, I feel a great bond. There haven't been very many of them. And when I was Solicitor General, while President Kennedy was still alive, former Solicitor General Stanley Reed was a retired Supreme Court justice. And just after the present Justice White, who was a Kennedy appointment, was put on the court, he was seated next to my wife at a dinner party. And he said, well, I'm very sorry that Archie wasn't appointed on this occasion. Well, because who's appointed is largely a matter of fate. And the pendulum may swing toward a person once, but if it doesn't swing all the way, it never swings back so far again. So that, at least, I suspected he was right, and that spared my ever, you know, sort of drooling at the prospect.
You would have wanted the job. Oh, I mean, of
course. Oh, there's... I'm not sure that the job of Solicitor General isn't more satisfying than even being on the court, but everybody would want to be on the court.
My guest is Archibald Cox. He's one of the leading authorities on constitutional and labor law. He has written a new book called The Court and the Constitution, and we're going to talk about probably what you all want to hear about, Watergate, in just a moment. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Archibald Cox. He has held numerous appointed positions in government, including the Solicitor General, and he was the first Watergate prosecutor until he was fired under the order of President Nixon in 1973. There is a man right now who is in the limelight who had a great effect on your life. I'm talking about Judge Robert Bork. He was the man who ultimately did fire you as special prosecutor. You must be inundated with questions about your opinions of his worth or unworth for the Supreme Court. Are you reluctant to talk about that?
Yes, I haven't and don't intend to. It's a very proper question for anyone in your position to ask. But I ask them and any, in this case, any listeners to understand I have a very strong feeling that one shouldn't either act on public questions in public office or give advice on public questions where an impartial, dispassionate advice may or may not, but may be mixed up with wholly irrelevant personal feelings that have been bruised in one way or another. No one can tell how to eliminate those feelings. I don't think anyone can even tell whether he has bruised personal feelings. There's always the subconscious. So I've simply thought it was more seemly for me to refrain from speaking on this subject, and I intend not to speak on it.
Okay, I'll respect that. When you were appointed special prosecutor, why did they choose you? I know Elliot Richardson had studied law under you, and you had known him for a long time, but certainly he wasn't just appointing a
friend. Well, I asked Elliot Richardson, why me? And I said, I've never prosecuted anybody. Why should I be special prosecutor? He said, oh, you can hire yourself some first-rate prosecutor. You have two things that are very important. You have the confidence of the United States Senate as a man who's fair, a man of principle and integrity. And two, you have the, from being a solicitor general, you have the confidence of the American lawyers. And that, too, is very important. So I guess he's as good as his advice on why he did it is as good as anybody's.
Could you have predicted the kind of constitutional conflict that ultimately resulted from your investigations?
No. My predictions, such as I made, and they were made only to my wife, but I remember this very vividly. We were discussing whether I should accept the invitation or not, and I said, well, this is a no-win job. What I had in mind was that there was a very high degree of probability that we never would get to the bottom of it. And what would be the result? Well, those who hate Nixon people would be saying if Cox weren't so dumb or if Cox hadn't sold out, he'd have found he was guilty. Mm-hmm. And the people who admired Richard Nixon, and there were still a great many, would be saying if Cox hadn't been a Kennedy man, he would have exonerated Richard Nixon. And I'd be left
between a rock and a hard place.
Yes. And, well, she said, you've taken no-win jobs before, as I had on one or two occasions. They've turned out very well. And I said, well, someone ought to engage in this effort to show that our system of government is capable of inquiring firmly and fairly into allegations of wrongdoing at the very highest levels of government. And it's, I guess, as good a person to do it as anyone is a tenured professor at Harvard who isn't going any place in public life anyway. Mm. Well, I was obviously all wrong in my predictions, but that's really an honest story.
You were fired ultimately because you refused to compromise with the White House over the tapes that you had subpoenaed President Nixon to turn over these tapes. Did you ever get to listen to any of these tapes?
I never have.
Never, not even at the archives?
No, I have thought of going to the archives building someday, but to do it, I would have to put on a wig and a false mustache. I don't think I'd look very good in a wig and false mustache.
Were you very frustrated after the firing? To watch the drama going on from the balcony as opposed to being center stage?
Well, I was... The thing that really was of concern to me was this was a great constitutional crisis in a sense. There were two great constitutional issues. One was whether, as a matter of law, the president, like everybody under the president, was subject to law and to court orders. And that had never been squarely decided in our courts. And so the courts did, in ordering him to produce the tapes, decided the president was no exception, and that is certainly consistent with our entire history and spirit.
Is this then because it was a criminal investigation rather than something else?
Well, the president had never been subjected, the president himself had never been subjected to a court order before. Mm-hmm. It had never come to a showdown. People under the president who were acting for him, yes, from the very beginning, Marbury and Madison, but never the president himself. Then the other thing was, when the courts did rule that the president has no immunity from law, could this be made real? Or was the law a paper tiger, as it were? As I quote Winston Churchill at one point in the book, democracy should never expose its weakness. If I forced this to a showdown, would all I do is show the weakness of the law and the Constitution as against a determined president who had all the muscle in terms of... And, of course, the only thing that could enforce the law and the court decree was the power of the people. If the people recognized that the ultimate safeguard of our liberties is the law and an independent judiciary, and used their moral and political power, then Richard Nixon would have to produce the tapes. On Friday, he refused. On Saturday, Tuesday, he sent his lawyer to court to say he would do it. And I honestly think, also, I was... Of course, I had some personal feelings that my whole mind was so concentrated on that very critical question that the rest of it didn't much matter to me.
You say it was the mind of the people. President Nixon had won in 1972 with a landslide victory. Wasn't there a danger that the people weren't going to go along with?
Well, I guess, indeed, that was why for several months I had been worrying about this. I used to talk about it with my staff. All right, we'll go, and the courtroom part will be easy. We'll make the best argument we can. We'll win or we'll lose. But if we win, and then he says, I won't do it, what do we do? And we would discuss all kinds of...
At one point you say it could have resembled a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta.
Well, yeah, at one point one of the lawyers on the staff, I think seriously said, well, let's get a posse of United States Marshals and send them to the White House to demand the tape. And someone else said, well, but they'll be met by the security guards. And another staff person said, it won't be the security guards, it'll be the Marines. And to that it was added, you may remember there was controversy over the Marines' fancy dress uniform. Yes, and they'll be in their fancy dress uniforms. And it was at that point that visions of Gilbert and Sullivan began to float through my mind.
Just very briefly, because we don't have much time left, why has it taken you 14 years to write about it in the prologue to your new book?
Well, I think other people should pass judgment on Watergate and on me. It's not for me to do.
Thank you very much, Archibald Cox. My guest has been Archibald Cox. He was the first Watergate prosecutor. He's a leading authority on constitutional law and labor law. He's written a new book entitled The Court and the Constitution, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Stuart Brand, founder of the Whole Earth Catalog and the Whole Earth Software Review. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Leanne Hansen, sitting in for the vacationing Terry Gross. Coming up, I'll speak with actor Danny Glover, co-star of the Broadway play Master Harold and the Boys by the anti-apartheid playwright Atul Fugard. Apartheid is also the subject of Glover's next feature role as Nelson Mandela in an upcoming television special. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews an album by Tom Verlaine, an all but unknown American guitar player who has attracted large audiences in Britain. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Fatal Attraction, starring Michael Douglas and Glenn Close, in which a one-night stand turns into a fatal obsession. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has a review of a new album from guitarist and songwriter Tom Verlaine. It's his fifth solo album since 1979, and Ken says Verlaine stands out as a true guitar virtuoso, one whose technique goes beyond flash.
One of the worst aspects of the contemporary rock world is its tendency to exalt performers who indulge in grand displays of technical prowess for its own sake. Working within a popular art whose initial charm was that the music was so simple and direct, rock has by now developed its own cult of the virtuoso. Many fans, critics, and performers themselves feel that elaborate proof of instrumental technique somehow elevates rock to the status of proper or legitimate music. This canard has led to an awful lot of pretentious junk. These thoughts occurred to me as I listened to Tom Verlaine's new album, Flashlight. Verlaine is one virtuoso rock guitarist who has managed to avoid the pitfalls of self-absorbed technique. Verlaine is, in some small circles, a revered guitar hero in much the same way Jimi Hendrix was. Verlaine's playing emphasizes long, spidery guitar lines that float and shimmer over a melody. Rather than proceed in an aimless fashion with lengthy solos, the hallmark of most rock guitar idols, Verlaine makes artful use of concise repetitions and quick musical figures to stitch a song together, to make it a tight, memorable composition. Over this, Verlaine sings in a rather tuneless, faint, conversational manner that is, depending on your point of view, either an annoying or charming contrast to his strong guitar playing. Here's a good example of that, a song called Cry Mercy Judge.
Cheers.
Tom Verlaine from his new album, Flashlight. Over the past decade, Verlaine hasn't become a true rock star. He just doesn't sell many records. He first came to attention as the leader of a band called Television, which was part of the New York New Wave rock movement in the late 70s, along with acts like the Ramones, Talking Heads, and Blondie. Television's first album, Marquee Moon, remains a high point of 70s rock and roll, as beautiful and lyrical an album as anyone has created. Television broke up at the end of the 70s, and since 1980, Verlaine has recorded 5 solo albums, none of which have fared well commercially. In fact, this new one, Flashlight, was first released a year ago in England, where Verlaine is far more popular. It's only now that an American record company, IRS, has shown any interest in releasing this excellent album by a strikingly original American guitarist.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Tom Verlaine's new album, Flashlight. This is the Sunday This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor Danny Glover. This summer, he starred as a cop in the box office hit Lethal Weapon, teaming up with Mel Gibson. Critics and audiences have been won over by some of his past movie performances, the sharecropper Moe's in Places in the Heart, Mister and Steven Spielberg's controversial adaptation of The Color Purple. His latest role is that of jailed South African leader Nelson Mandela, this month on home box office. Danny Glover was a political activist in San Francisco before he became an actor and began working in the theater. He's acted in many plays by South African playwright Athol Fugard and made his Broadway debut in Fugard's Master Harold and the Boys.
I had a very rare opportunity to work with a friend of mine, Zates Mokai, who is a wonderful South African actor and a very dear friend, and also worked with a man whose work I think I've become pretty well associated with over the last 10 years, Athol Fugard. I mean, it's a rare treat.
One night when you were doing Master Harold and the Boys, the director, Robert Benton, I believe, was
in the audience. Robert was in the audience, and he was in the audience at Yale Rep, in fact, and saw it again opening night, and thought kindly enough of me to invite me to audition or talk to him about Moe's in Places in the Heart.
When I saw that movie, Places in the Heart, there's a scene where Moe's is talking to the 9-year-old son of the Sally Field character, and he's telling the boy not to rock a rocking chair with no one in it, superstitious. And that scene was very reminiscent of some of the things that went on in Master Harold and the Boy, that kind of relationship that existed
there. Yeah, I think they both, for Willie, who I played in Master Harold and the Boys, and also for Moe's, they both became were surrogate fathers in a sense. And it's such a moving. I remember every time I would see that scene in doing publicity. I started crying because it was just such a wonderful story. And Yankton, the young boy, was so, he's the most, I mean, it would be the boy you want to bring home. He was so sweet. He was such a gentleman and so sweet.
You grew up, went to college in San Francisco.
Yes, I did.
It was a very politically active time mm-hmm. at that time, during the 60s. Mm-hmm. Were you politically active?
Yes, I was very much as a college student and as well as a participant in whatever the community politics were at that particular time.
Were you acting at the time? Did your acting take on a sort of political statement as well?
Well, my acting came as a result of the other things.
As the political
things. As the other things, as I became more involved and listened. And it was, I think the use of art, whether it be, and it was so strong. If you look at some of the art at that time, whether it be poetry, dance, it's a characteristic of people of a generation trying to establish, trying to find, trying to get some foothold, trying to throw off the shackles that they felt had been, that they had struggled with for so long, and try to look at a new vision.
You read Nelson Mandela's book, No Easy Walk.
No Easy Walk to
Freedom.
Yeah.
It had an effect on you.
Well, certainly it did. I mean, the thing about what makes things so dramatic is I'm doing a film on Nelson Mandela. I've done a film on Nelson Mandela. So one person may pick one thing that was a catalyst in my whole development at a time and my whole way of thinking. But certainly there were several books at that time. No Easy Walk to Freedom was one among many books that I read. Franz Fanon's Wretched of the Earth was another book that I read at that time. Dealing with different other philosophies, politically, economically, and socially, was what I was interested in.
How did you synthesize all of these things to create then the character of Mandela that we do see in the HBO
well,
special?
Well, I don't synthesize. I mean, I think that what you try to do, you try to find what are the basic things about this human being. What are the things that endear you to him because he's emotionally alive just as you are, you know, that he does the same things that you are. There's definitely some things with Mandela that connected me to him. He was a fanatic about exercise. I understand that, too. I'm a fanatic about exercise.
Doing push-ups in the prison,
yeah.
Running in place.
Running in place, the kind of dedication to that, which I think helps in a dedication to other things. You know, if you focus, find something that you can concentrate and focus on, that concentration becomes relevant to that, what you're doing, but also has some ramifications on other things that you do.
Was it a particular challenge for you, knowing that you are doing this character, Nelson Mandela? He's almost Shakespearean, he's heroic, but he's also a man who is still alive, who is still in jail, trying to maintain that balance dramatically.
Well, I don't think that's a very hard thing to do. You don't. I mean, the only thing that you do, the pitfalls are saying, I think he does it this way. I think he would be like this. In doing saying, I think he would be like this, you separate yourself from the man's ideas, his thoughts, his inner feelings. The wonderful thing about the imagination and the wonderful thing about acting is that you can assume a number of things. I mean, there are things that I could assume that he thought, that he may have thought, but only he can tell me that he didn't think those things in his innermost thoughts. You know, I can imagine those things. I can have the greatest use of my fantasy world and my imagination to think that. And so that's what the words are, you know. The words are flowery and glorious and Shakespearean and mythical in a sense. But what they do, they're my words as well.
We organized a defiance campaign. And what was their response? Our leaders were imprisoned and banned. We called the Congress of the People. And how did they respond? 156 people were charged with high treason. We called for one-day strikes and bus boycotts. We burned our passes. And how did they respond? By killing 69 men, women, and children at Sharpeville. I tell you, my brothers, my sisters, We have now the moral right to defend ourselves. Self-defense is the right. I shall fight the government side by side with you, inch by inch and mile by mile, until victory is won. And what will you do? You come along with us or remain silent and neutral in this matter of life and death. For my own part, I have made my choice. I will not leave South Africa, nor will I surrender.
This special basically says that Nelson Mandela should be freed. Is that true?
Well, it certainly says more than that. As a general basis of what it's about, it certainly tries to shed some light on that struggle, the painstaking evolution of that struggle to the point where it is now. It moves in that direction. That certainly we can use many more hours of film of dialogue to discuss that and give full dynamics to what's happening, full breath to what's happening with those dynamics, rather.
Do you consider yourself a big box office star now that you've had, well, Lethal Weapon? You're all over the place, do you?
Oh, no. I mean, what actually does that mean, you know? I mean, someone else who's making a film would have to say Danny Zuglover's a big box office star and does that. This business is so fickle in a way. It borders and it establishes and creates these illusions, and they're illusions in the real sense of the word. And I don't like to deal in them, you know. Somebody's just willing to give me a job, and that's cool, you know.
Danny Glover, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Okay, then, thank you.
Danny Glover can be seen this month in the HBO special Mandela. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Leanne.
Well, I assume you're going to have some stories from here in Philadelphia on the 200th birthday of the Constitution.
You assume correctly. We'll also be hearing from Fred Barbash, who's written a book about the convention, talking about the actual signing of the document. And also, we'll hear about a man who swims laps and in each lap thinks about a different article or amendment to the Constitution. That's right, we actually will. Also, a report on Judge Robert Bork's day before the Judiciary Committee and an interview with Senator Howell Heflin of Alabama, one of the key swing votes, a Democrat but a conservative one, on the issue of Judge Bork's nomination.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The new movie, Fatal Attraction, is director Adrian Lyne's first film since 9.5 weeks. He also made Flashdance and Foxes. Fatal Attraction stars Michael Douglas and Glenn Close, and our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
Every couple of years, the producers Sherry Lansing and Stanley Jaffe make what they think is a penetrating look at the American family, and what I think is a grade C monster movie. The last one was First Born, in which Terry Garr married handsome Peter Weller, who turned out to be a drug-crazed killer. The new one, Fatal Attraction, is more compelling, but even more sloppily made. This is a movie about the dire consequences of going out for hamburger when you can have steak at home. By which I mean, Michael Douglas plays a happy, handsome lawyer married to happy, pretty Ann Archer. They have a happy, goofy 6-year-old daughter. You can tell they're happy because the scenes about their home life are so unremittingly banal that you'll have to bite your lip to keep from snoozing through them. Anne Archer is very beautiful, but she conveys her wonderfulness by grinning blearily through every scene. You think to yourself, okay, so Michael Douglas married the head cheerleader, but why can't she stop cheering? Finally, along comes trouble. Douglas is working with a publishing firm, and one of the new editors there is Glenn Close. Here she is seducing him over what the movie says is drinks, which made me wonder why they were ordering coffee afterward.
Can we have two coffees, please? Well, I tell you, it's...
You want one?
No, thank you. Yeah. It's funny being a lawyer, you know, it's like being a doctor. Everybody's telling you their innermost secrets.
Oh, my God. You just have to be discreet.
Oh, God, yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, my what?
Discreet.
Yes, I'm discreet.
Me too.
Close has never been my idea of a seductress, but let that pass. What happens is that she and Douglas spend a weekend together when Douglas's wife is out of town. And the director, Adrian Lyne, is the guy who made 9 1/2 weeks, so he knows how to turn on the hot and heavy stuff. Okay, they have an affair, and Douglas thinks it's over. But since this is a Sherry Lansing-Stanley Jaffe movie, Close immediately stops being the seductive, intelligent, witty person we thought she was supposed to be, and turns into a psychotic monster who won't leave Douglas and his family in peace. As her eyes get eerier and her hair gets more tenderly, and she spends every waking hour stalking Douglas and his family, well, I kind of wondered how her job was going. Is she still lunching hot writers and poring over manuscripts? Has the gang at the office noticed she's gone a little bonkers? Or are they telling her, "Yo, Glenn, that tenderly look, love it"? The movie ought to tell us these things. Instead, it keeps doggedly thudding toward its histrionic climax, which, like the climax of any Friday the 13th monster movie, happens about 3 times. I wouldn't mind all this so much if, A, Fatal Attraction would just admit to what it is and go all out for the scare, or B, if, like the character study it pretends to be, it actually had characters in it, or C, if the plot weren't so transparently a series of booby traps, just waiting for Douglas and his family to step into them, which they do. Don't you make the same mistake.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Here's a look at our next show. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Ralph Bakshi. He did the animation for the cult hits Fritz the Cat and Heavy Traffic. He's left animation for his first love, oil painting. Also, guest commentator Randall Grass pays tribute to reggae singer Peter Tosh, who was killed last weekend in his native Jamaica. And critic at large Laurie Stone will review Jenny and the Jaws of Life, a collection of short stories by Jincy Willett. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Leanne Hansen. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.